so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking this hour about jumping worms with Brad Herrick. Brad's the new director of the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve, and great to have him with us. He previously served as an ecologist and the research program manager for the UW-Madison Arboretum, and he has done a lot of work and research on jumping worms, which is what we're going to be talking about. And I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about jumping worms? Do you know how to find and identify them? And if they are in your garden, what should you do about them? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brad Herrick, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be back.
Jumping worms. All right, let's just start with the basics. What are they?
Yeah, let's start there. So these earthworms, and they are earthworms, they're referred to as jumping worms because of their erratic behavior. They don't have legs, because they're earthworms. They're segmented creatures, but they really have a rigid body type that allows them, when they're disturbed, either by hands picking them up or something else, they will flop around on the ground very dramatically. They'll try and slither away from you, kind of like a snake. They're also called snake worms because of that. So their behavior is really distinctive. They are a group of earthworms that are not native to North America. In fact, they are native to parts of Asia, so China, Japan, the Korean Peninsula, and there's many different species. And the first identified jumping worm species in North America was in California about 100 years ago. So actually, as a group, they've been on the continent for a while, but only the past 15, 20 years have researchers, gardeners, landscapers started to notice something different happening. These new worms are spreading very quickly now, and they're able to overwinter in our environment. And they have a lot of impacts that I know we'll get into here, depending on the type of habitat, type of soil, how they interact with other native species. And I know that your audience, Larry, has had a lot of experience with jumping worms from my past conversations. So I'm looking forward to getting into it.
And they're so much different from the other earthworms. I mean, in their their nature.
Yeah, yeah, and
they're kind of bullies in a way.
Yeah. So, and maybe to back up a little bit, it's good for your audience to know that in Wisconsin and any other area of North America that was under a glacier during the last ice age, there are no native earthworms, and so the thought there is that earthworms that were around pre-glaciation were either killed off by the action of the glaciers, or the climate was inhospitable, and so they all moved south, you know, over the course of thousands of years, and they have not, you know, moved back north. They're earthworms. They take a long time to really go anywhere if they don't have help. So there are native earthworms south of the glacier, so in the mid-U.S., south, there's lots of native earthworms, but not in Wisconsin. So any earthworm that you find in Wisconsin are not native. And so most of the ones that you're familiar with are European. So, for example, the common nightcrawler, everyone knows and loves for fishing, really large earthworm. They can burrow down really deep in the soil. That is a Lumbricus species from Europe. And all these European species were likely brought over when Europeans arrived, you know, several hundred years ago, brought over not on purpose necessarily, but just through, you know, plants they brought over or soil or who knows. But lots of different ways they came over. And they are a fundamentally different species than these jumping worms. They look different. They behave, like Larry, like you mentioned, they behave very differently. And maybe most importantly, they have different impacts on forests and gardens than jumping worms do. You know, as a gardener, Larry, you've probably have been told for years and years that earthworms are your friend, right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
That's the message. And that is very true for the European species. They can really help a garden system. They're really good at turning over the soil and mixing nutrients into the soil. They help infiltrate water into the root zone. And so that's very true in sort of this agricultural garden sort of human-made system mm-hmm. that we have in terms of gardens, our landscaping. But jumping worms, because they are so different, they actually have a very negative effect on gardens because they are only living in the top part of soil. And again, I'm sure we'll get questions here, but gardeners are well aware of this at this point, probably. And so they're every year that they're there, they're just turning over that top few inches of the soil. They're not digging burrows, not going very deep, so they're not mixing any nutrients into the root zone. They're not really aiding, water from entering the root zone. And what happens is that because they're turning over that soil so much in the same area, that still becomes really loose, really granular. It doesn't hold water very well. It actually, those castings, which are the earthworm's excrement, so they're eating organic matter, pooping out what looks like little soil pellets that are more or less hydrophobic, so they actually repel water. So they really behave differently, and because of that, they have different effects on our garden soil, usually negative effects from what we're seeing.
Yeah. Well, it was in 2013, I think, mm-hmm. that jumping worms were first confirmed in the upper
That's
Midwest
right.
at the Arboretum.
Yep, just a few miles south of us here. And with most invasive species or non-native species, we don't really know when the first individual arrived somewhere, right? So it's likely that they were in Wisconsin for a couple years, but no one had confirmed that. And so the Arboretum, good or bad, is on record as the first confirmed location in Wisconsin with jumping worms. And for those of you not familiar with the UW-Madison Arboretum, similar to Lakeshore Nature Preserve, it's a natural area, there are some horticultural plantings as well, and so we would bring in mulch and plants from all over the world, and likely, jumping worms were introduced through that process.
And you were, by the way, you were at the Arboretum for, 17 years, something
years.
Like
yep.
that?
Yep, yep. So, yeah, I pre and post jumping worms, I guess, is how I describe my time there now.
And so what kind of research have you done or did mm-hmm. you do?
Yeah, and still doing research on jumping worms. But we've done a lot of work on looking at the impacts of jumping worms on soil processes. So how do jumping worms compared to other earthworms, how do they change nutrients and soil carbon in forests? We're asking basic questions about how they're spreading through the landscape. And some of this work is ongoing, so I don't have a lot of kind of quantitative data to share at this point, but those are the questions that we're asking. Right now, we're actually working on a phenology study. And so what that means, the word phenology means kind of tracking the timing of these biological events, right? So
sure.
the first time you hear a cardinal call in the spring. Well, that phenology also works with earthworms. So jumping worms, they're an annual species, which is another big difference between European species and jumping worms. They're annual, so right about now there's very few left in the environment because we've had some cold nights, and so all the adults are perishing. But as an evolutionary strategy, they lay a lot of eggs, or cocoons they're called, and so those cocoons are winter hardy. And so they are what allow the population to persist the following year. What we want to know is, well, when do those cocoons hatch in the spring? And how long does it take for these baby earthworms to grow and to become mature, where they can start to lay the new generation of cocoons? And then when do they actually die? And why is that important? Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. The ecology... or the biology of the earthworms and how that biology affects the ecology. So when might we expect to see the biggest changes in soil chemistry, for example? Mm-hmm. Is it early in the year when there's a flush of little babies, or is it later in the year when these earthworms are really large and they're probably feeding a lot more? And the timing of this life cycle can also impact how we control them. If we have a technique to control them, say using certain organic chemicals, or we use heat, is it better to do that in April, maybe, or in the middle of the year, or maybe the end of the year when they're more likely to be laying these eggs? Do we try and get them, remove them before that happens? So it's a basic question that has potential implications for ecology and control. And what we're finding really quickly, so we've had 2 years of data now, and of course, the 2 years that we've been tracking them have been very odd years in terms of,
of course,
drought and wetness, and so we don't have, that's how it goes. So next year we're going to do it, and it's going to be, everything will be average across the board, and we'll get good data. But so if folks in southern Wisconsin that are listening, you know that in 2023 we had a dry spring, kind of a pretty extreme drought for a while. But then we did get precipitation at the end of the year. This year it was the opposite. It was really a wet spring, and then it's been very dry here. And what we're finding is that timing of drought is what's important. And so, for example, in 2023 we had very few jumping worms around because it was dry in the spring at a time when they want to start hatching. And there wasn't moisture for them to hatch and to feed. And so those cocoons, a lot of them just didn't hatch. They lay dormant. And so that results in a low population. Even though we had precipitation later in the year, it was too late for these earthworms to really mature. This year, it was really wet in the spring, and they went bananas. We had tons of earthworms, jumping worms this year. And even though it has been dry, that pulse of rain for a month in April, May, that was enough to hatch a lot of jumping worms and for their population to sort of maintain high levels through the year. And I'm curious if people have seen that as well throughout the state.
Yeah, I'd like to know that. If you have, if you've seen that, or maybe you have an experience you want to share, you know, we have something from Helen, but what about you? Question, give us a call, or experiences relating to jumping worms, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Our guest, Brad Herrick, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at jumping worms on the show today with a guy who's done a lot of research on them, Brad Herrick. He previously served as an ecologist and research program manager for the UW-Madison Arboretum and now directs the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve. So good to have him with us. Let's go to the phones. Margaret in Sun Prairie, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Oh, and I'm hoping that you'll get me because I'm actually in my car, so I don't know if there'll be feedback. First of all, thank you for letting me be on here, and thank you for your guest. I noticed the jumping worms in my yard about 3 years ago in one area, and the only reason I knew what they were is because I'd been to the expo and had attended one of the seminars and learned about them, so I was alerted to them. And at that time, they were tiny, and I pulled the mulch back in the area of the garden and got what I thought was most of them. But this year, they just exploded in numbers, and they were three or four times larger than the initial ones that I found. And that's when I realized that they truly are at the top of the soil, because there'd been rain. I'd go and pull the mulch back. In one picking, I would pick up two, three dozen of them, put them in a plastic bag and let them sit in the sun to die. I put the mulch back, water, and the next day I'd go back and pull the mulch back, and I would find the same thing over and over until finally, about the fifth or sixth time I did that process, there weren't any left in that area. So that's maybe alerted me that next year I just might be having to search every part of my garden, and I have a large number of gardens in my yard. So my comment was just that, you know, did I see it explode because of the, or the exploded numbers because of the rain? And yes, that was my experience.
Yeah, thanks, Margaret. That's your experience, unfortunately, is pretty common in terms of what you're seeing in your garden. So I guess one thing to share is that you're not alone in this. But right, so for sure, it sounds like the moisture was a driver, especially here in Sun Prairie, I think you mentioned, and that's exactly what we're seeing here in Madison, where this wet spring, that timing of moisture was a really strong catalyst for their hatching, and right, I mean the thing that we're learning about these jumping worms too is that their cocoons, while they are triggered by moisture and by soil temperature in terms of hatching, some will choose not to hatch. They will lay dormant. Sort of think of like a plant seed bank. Mm-hmm. They produce this cocoon bank, and for whatever reason, and so the numbers, even if you didn't see many the year before, there could still be cocoons that added to the cocoons that were laid this year or the year previous. And so that could be another reason why you're seeing a lot this year, because there were a lot of buildup of cocoons in the soil, even though you can't see them, they're really small. But this level of moisture was perfect, and so you had more hatching this year than you might have in previous years. And yeah, you know, sometimes picking them out one by one is what you're left with. I know that's not always a really satisfying technique, especially if you have a large invasion. There are other techniques that folks are trying that you might think about as well, and others might think about this too. It's highly dependent on your situation, but we're seeing and hearing a lot of potential benefit of using solarization in your garden. So the one thing that we know works on earthworms and their cocoons is heat. So earthworms can't tolerate very hot temperatures, and their cocoons at 104 degrees Fahrenheit, that's a temperature threshold limit for cocoons, their embryos will be non-viable. And so if we can think of ways to heat up that top layer of soil, that would affect the earthworms and their cocoons. And one way to do that is if you, in the spring, before they start hatching, before your plants start to pop, in your garden, if you have a south-facing landscape and not a lot of tree canopy, and you can lay down some clear plastic over that soil, that'll heat up pretty fast, even in a March, April sun. So it kind of creates that greenhouse effect, and that heat doesn't need to penetrate the soil very far, because like you mentioned, Margaret, you're seeing them in the top layer of soil, and that's where they're also laying there these cocoons. I've gotten some feedback from gardeners over the years that that's actually worked pretty well. It's a fairly inexpensive. You don't have to worry about, you know, chemical applications or other things. And it can be effective on larger scales, and it's easier on your back too than having to pick up jumping worms all day long. So
yeah, that's a good, some good advice there. Margaret, thanks for calling. Tanya in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. So my daughter has jumping worms in her garden as well in Oshkosh. And they have definitely made the soil so hard that you can't hardly put a shovel into it. But her garden still is beautiful, and it flourishes uncontrollably. But good news there. But I was wondering if there was a way that, like, a beneficial nematodes or something like that, when bringing in a predator, would help that situation. And then when you said the solaring of the garden, could you still do that possibly in the winter? Put that plastic on the winter and maybe kill some of them off? Obviously it'd be hard to get it too hot, but I know under plastic on a nice sunny day, you know, there's not too much snow on the ground.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I've not heard that suggestion about doing the solarization in the winter, but I don't see why that wouldn't work. And I think it would have to be a very specific landscape condition for that to work, like, you know, south facing, like I said, no canopy. But yeah, if you're able to, I think that the big thing there would be to make sure that you're getting bare soil and then the plastic over it so that you're not buffering that temperature between like a compost or litter that goes right into the soil. Certainly worth a try though. And to your first observation, often with jumping worms, what we see is kind of the opposite of what you're describing. We see a looser, more granular soil structure rather than a compacted, hard structure. Not to say that, you know, what you're seeing isn't jumping worm by any means. It very well could be. But sometimes with the more compact soil, that is a characteristic of European earthworms that that through their activity, they tend to make a more compact soil that actually keeps the soil warmer than jumping worms would with that more porous topsoil that they create. So not that, you know, the conditions are always different, but if your daughter has confirmed jumping worms, then, you know, then she's seeing something that's a little bit different than what maybe other people are seeing, but definitely interesting nonetheless.
Yeah. Thank you, Tanya, for calling. Appreciate it. Anne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have been told a number of times that the jumping worms deplete the nutrition in the soil because they live in the top few inches. They're competing with the plant roots. And I'm wondering, long term, is it correct that our soils become poorer and poorer? I found my first jumping worms in my compost pile, so I stopped using my compost pile. And I'm wondering, is there a problem long term? And if there is there any way you can fool them? Liquid fertilizer? Something that isn't going to give them a lot of organic matter to chew on?
So, that's a great question. And one of the questions that I'm looking at as well. And we don't know kind of what the impacts, long-term impacts are, because we haven't been studying them very long. They haven't been around long enough to get some, you know, that longitudinal data set. However, we know that jumping worms, because of how they eat a lot of the organic matter on the soil, and they turn that into castings, which are nutrient-rich, right? That's we know that. The issue with the jumping worms is that, like I mentioned earlier, they're not incorporating those nutrient-rich, you know, castings or pellets into the soil profile. And so being left on top of the soil, they're very susceptible to being washed away, which we've seen at the Arboretum, being eroded. Sometimes because they're even though they are often kind of hide, they seem to repel water. They can also leach some of those nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus out of the soil profile. Instead of leaching vertically, they leach out of those castings on the surface of the soil. So we're sort of talking in generalities right now without a lot of data behind it, but that's what we suspect is happening, and we've seen that happen in some of these sort of smaller controlled trials. So now we're looking at what happens actually in the field. So we'll have more data soon on that.
Yeah. As you were talking, and I think I brought this up on a show once, but I grew up in the Cottage Grove area where there was a fair amount of tobacco grown.
Yeah.
And the tobacco beds in the spring, there were people that came around and steamed the beds. And before the tobacco plants the seeds went in, because that just killed off everything. Yep. And so steaming, I don't know if they're still steaming the beds anymore, but that would be one way to get rid of them in a hurry.
For sure, yeah. And that has come up in conversations, a steam treatment, yeah. Just maybe you can rent, you can rent a steamer at the local hardware store with a carpet steamer and run it through your. But that's exactly right. That would be, and that kind of direct heat treatment would be a quick control versus having to have it heat up over time.
Yeah. So, well, I just thought about that because those beds, those steamers were. I mean, you never had weeds.
Yeah.
In those beds.
Yeah.
Because all the seeds were dead.
yeah. And it's, it's in a more organic way of addressing weeds.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark in Arlington, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Well, Larry, about, I don't know, 4 years ago or so like that, I went and ended up moving some dirt from over by Sun Prairie up to a place that I had. And it was probably about a 10 by 10 area, about 4 foot tall, and I noticed what must have been jumping worms because they'd almost stand on end. And in order to keep the rain and everything from washing all the dirt away, I ended up covering it with some of that heavy plastic that's used on farms for bagging. And it's white on one side and black on the other. And I covered that up and ended up leaving it on there for a year and a half. And after that, I never saw another worm.
There you go.
There you go. Good for you, Mark.
Thanks for that call.
Appreciate that. Sarah in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think I had jumping worms probably come in with loaded mulch in my garden, and you'll probably talk more about different ways to try to alleviate them, but if I've done the mustard wash to get them to surface, I'm curious if picking them then and feeding them to my chickens is a viable way to, eliminate them if chickens are a viable predator. I've read conflicting reports about the toxicity or the disruption that they may cause to the chicken's digestion. And I'm just curious about any research you've heard about using chickens as a real predator for them.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's some research on the ability of earthworms to take up heavy metals from the soil, and that is true. So because of they are eating leaves, they're eating soil. So whatever's in those material, in theory, they are putting into their bodies. And so the only way though that it's going to be harmful for your chickens is if, for example, your soil is full of lead, for example. There's not a lot of research that would suggest that they have levels of heavy metals that would be detrimental to animals, whether it's your chickens or then you eating your chickens. I don't think that's a concern. Again, if your soil has a lot of heavy metals, and you have a lot of earthworms that are eating that, and you feed a lot of earthworms to your chickens, and then you see how that can build up. But otherwise, I don't think it's a real concern. And you know, there's a lot of predators for sure that could eat jumping worms, that do eat earthworms, from birds like chickens to small mammals, raccoons, possums, amphibians. Interestingly, we've done some research on toads. I was part of a research project looking at the effects if toads would eat jumping worms, and they didn't really care for them. which is funny. They were kind of picky. They enjoyed night crawlers, but jumping worms, they would be interested in them, but they wouldn't eat them. And so I'd be curious if your chickens, and maybe you've already tried this, if they would actually consume them. We think the toads either were scared off by their erratic jumping behavior, or maybe they're to, you know, different body chemistry that they didn't like very much. But it's interesting ecologically because these are new organisms to this environment. So the animals here are still getting used to this novel food source and trying to figure out, you know, is this something that I can eat? Should I eat it? And so eventually, you know, it'll become an important food source, and that'll be our sort of natural control for these critters.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Sarah. She mentioned a mustard wash, and we probably should talk about what that is.
Yeah. Yes. The old mustard wash. So, this is a technique that, researchers use a lot, and actually teachers have often used with their classes because it's a really easy way to see what kind of earthworms you have in the soil. So it's literally you're combining dried mustard powder with a gallon of water, so maybe a half a cup of dried mustard powder. Again, this is like not the fancy Dijon spicy mustard. It's just straight yellow mustard mixed with water, and you pour it over the soil. And what happens is that as that solution infiltrates the soil, when it comes into contact with an earthworm, the mustard itself, they don't like how that feels on their skin. Earthworms don't have lungs, but they take in oxygen through their pores in their skin, and so they take in water that way as well. And their reaction to that mustard is to burrow vertically to get out of that area. And so that's how it works. And so they come to the surface. If you're a researcher, you might count the different earthworms you have. You might, you know, try and control them that way, pick them out, put them in a plastic bag, like's been mentioned before. But it's a safe, it's really inexpensive. As an earthworm researcher and general earthworm nerd, I buy mustard powder by the 30-pound box and just use it up quickly. So it's pretty fun that way.
And I suppose if you had a vacuum cleaner with a hose attachment,
there you go.
You could go out.
All sorts of good ideas.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see. I did want to mention Helen because I brought it up earlier. Helen had emailed quite a while back and at the compost pile. She had this really nice one, and suddenly she's got jumping worms in it. She's wondering, can she use the compost? Do jumping worms drive out European earthworms or other soil critters?
Yeah. Both good questions. So the first one, in terms of using your compost, if you know that you already have jumping worms in your garden bed, in your compost, then you're not really doing any more harm by adding that. If you don't have them in your garden, I don't think you do, then I would try what the gentleman that called in earlier tried to do, is adding that plastic covering and trying to heat up that compost pile. To see if you can get rid of those jumping worms and their cocoons before using it. So it kind of depends on your situation. And then I'm forgetting the other question.
Oh, do jumping worms drive out other European earthworms?
Yes.
And other soil critters.
And other soil critters, yes. That's what we're seeing at the Arboretum in these long-term studies and other places as well. We don't know what the mechanism is, you know, why this is happening, but in the forests that we've been working in at the Arboretum, there are now no other earthworm species besides jumping worms, completely void, or devoid. So that's really interesting. And we're trying to, you know, what does that mean? That's a good question, you know, in terms of biology-wise, ecology-wise. But there's some interaction there where European species, whether they're the night crawlers that go really deep or ones that maybe don't burrow quite as deep, they're having the same effect. They're either being outcompeted, they're moving away from jumping worms. Maybe jumping worms are better at competing for food. Maybe there's a weird body chemistry that jumping worms have that is just not what other earthworms like. And so, you know, is that good or bad? We don't know because they're both non-native species. They both have effects on ecosystems. Yeah. So that's more to be studied there, but it's an interesting observation that you made.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken in Mayville, we'll get to you in a minute. Carol in Madison, Steve in Superior, you're all up next. Reminder, though, that Brad Herrick, our guest today, a director of the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Taking a look at jumping worms now with Brad Herrick of the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve. Great to have him with us. And Ken in Mayville has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Ken, hello.
Yeah, hey, I've got a really bad infestation I got probably 8 years ago. I pretty much just gave up on gardening altogether. I grow a few things now, but I'm going to go back and listen to all these other comments for controlling them. But what I've heard, and I haven't used yet, but I know golf courses use a product called Castaway that kills earthworms because you don't want those on the golf course. And what I hear, it's made out of tea tree meal, so like the byproduct when they make tea tree oil. Have you heard or tried using that product? Or?
Yep. That's a good question, good comment. So this is one of a couple of different control options that's been tried, and Castaway is a brand name of this. There's one called Early Bird that used to be in the market, and there's others. And what it is, it's an organic fertilizer that is mixed with plant saponins, which are naturally occurring compound that plants use as a defense mechanism. And some plants have a higher concentration than others. And just a quick correction, it's actually not tea tree meal, it's tea seed meal, which is a different, it's a byproduct of tea seed oil that is used a lot in cooking, especially in Asian countries. And so this byproduct is really high in these saponins. And it's the saponins themselves that are actually the control for the earthworms, but it's often been mixed with fertilizer for golf course use. So it's sort of a double whammy. You get grass growing and you get rid of these earthworms that, like the caller mentioned, creates little mound on the greens and causes havoc for golfers. It does work on jumping worms. It works on all earthworms, probably other soft-bodied organisms. The thing to know about those products is that they are not certified for use for earthworm control or any other in terms of using it in a garden setting or in your yard. And so, you know, golf course managers use it for the fertilizer, and then as sort of a side benefit, they also control jumping worms. But so that's the one caveat there, and so I don't recommend it just because it's not on label, but it does work. But it's the saponins, the plant chemicals, that are actually doing the work. And so there are, I think, some I know University of Minnesota, University of Vermont, and some other places that are looking at isolating the actual saponins or saponins, as they're pronounced, that actually do the work of controlling earthworm rather than adding, because you don't want to be adding necessarily more fertilizer, more nutrients to your soil. That's just going to help dumping worm potentially. But that's a good, it's a good comment, and there's more research being done there.
Ken, thank you. Carol in Madison, on to you. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have extensive perennial gardens, and they are full of jumping worms. I kill them when I see them. I'm interested in the putting down clear plastic. And could I do that in March or April without killing my perennial plants that are in the garden? Or will that damage the plants?
Yep, question. That's a perfect question. Yep, so... that's actually the great benefit of doing this kind of solarization is that, if you do it in March and April, that's perfect. It's either going to be right before your perennials, pop or, you know, maybe at the same time, but it's not, it will not kill the roots or the bulbs of your perennials. Those are down lower. The worst case, you know, scenario is if we have a really early spring and the plants start to pop, you had the plastic down, they might have be slower to rebound, or some of the early leaves might die back, but they will still grow that year. They will not die. And that's, because again, the heat is only penetrating that top, you know, inch to 2 inches where you really want it for the jumping worm control.
And how long does that sheeting need to be down?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really depends on your situation. If you have the research shows that at 104 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 days, that's in the lab. That's what we tested. That was what was needed. If you get it higher than that, it's probably less time. So if you can get it to be, you know, if you put it down for a week, and you get really good, you know, solar radiation coming, that's going to be plenty. Again, it's that if you have conditions that are maybe you only have a couple hours of direct sunlight a day, then maybe put it on there for a week to 10 days.
Okay. And Carol, thank you. And Steve in Superior, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, Larry, love your show. Fred, just from part of your research, have you thought about the impacts of nitrogen on this invasive trend with the jumping worms? And I just know that so many of our invasive plants are definitely in response to nitrogen, and maybe they shouldn't be considered invasive, but instead of symptomatic of high nitrogen, and also how these plants have changed to more labile, higher nitrogen content material that would be, it seems to me, very edible to the worm. So, I'll listen to what you have to say, and I appreciate your time and your work very much. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot of interactions there potentially. And so are the earthworms responding to higher nitrogen in the soil, which is why they're doing so well, or are they you know, are the leaves? So, well, let me back up. So one of the questions maybe that you're getting at too is, especially in urban areas where we have more nitrogen deposition coming from, you know, burning of fossil fuels, for example, that are enriching the soil with nitrogen and or enriching, and then the plants take that up through the roots, those leaves are higher nitrogen, and which the earthworms love, and the cycle continues, right? And so if there was less nitrogen in the soil to begin with, would the earthworms be doing as well? And I have no answers. Those are perfect questions, though, and questions that we hope to address with some of these longer-term studies looking at how these earthworms do modify potentially or are modified by soil chemistry levels? Good question.
Good question indeed. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Brad, I want to turn to the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve. I think the UW campus sits on 900 acres, and about 300 of those acres are the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Center. Talk about it.
Yeah, so that's a, it should be a well-known fact, but maybe it's not. It's, so the campus here in Madison is a little over 900 acres, and a third of that is in green space, and in this case, natural area, which is a really unique situation for a university this size. And it represents an incredible opportunity for not only the faculty and students here, but K-12 students and teachers, volunteers, the community at large, not, again, not just in Madison, but Dane County and throughout Wisconsin, to come to a vibrant campus and learn about natural area at the same time. The Lakeshore Nature Preserve, like Larry said, is 300 acres. It encompasses 4 miles of Lake Mendota shoreline. And this is a very special area, not only for teaching and research, but also in terms of the Ho-Chunk cultural heritage. This is Ho-Chunk ancestral land, and so it's an incredibly important area in the Four Lakes region in terms of Ho-Chunk heritage. And so what makes my job and my staff's job that much more important is that we're not only maintaining and preserving this landscape for students and faculty, but also for our Ho-Chunk colleagues and friends. And one of the really exciting things, Larry, happening now is that there is in the works a new outreach center that is being designed, and this is directly from a very generous gift from Jerry Frouchy and the Frouchy family, who've been very generous over the years, contributing to the arts in Madison, to other community opportunities. Part of the Lakeshore was donated from the Frouchies, the Frouchy Point, and they've given a generous sum of money to build this. It's a game-changing building. It's a state-of-the-art building in terms of sustainability. It's considered a living building, so it's the first building in Wisconsin to be built under this living building challenge, which is, if you're familiar with the LEED certification, it's a step above that. One of only 34 buildings in the world to be built under the certification. And it's going to be actually produce energy, so a net positive energy. And so, you know, in line with the Chancellor's RISE initiative on sustainability, this is going to be a model for how we can build sustainable buildings moving forward. And it's an entry point for people that want to visit the preserve, a chance to share with people about, you know, what the preserve is all about before they head out onto the land. And if folks are interested in this building, the ideas behind it, and what it represents to Wisconsin, there's opportunities for support of this. Again, with any building, we also want to build in programs. So we want to be able to share with people outreach opportunities. And so there is, if you go to Lakeshore Nature Preserve, there's a fund, Lakeshore Nature Preserve Frouchy Center Fund for the Future, that people can go to and share their support.
And on that note, you know, get you back. I'm sorry,
great.
We didn't have enough time to talk about the whole Lakeshore Nature Center. So let's make a date to come back and have you talk about that center.
That'd
be great. And go into more depth on it, because there's a lot going on there. Brad Herrick, our guest, and he directs the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve. Lots to talk about with him. And I'm looking forward to visiting with him again. Always great to have our producers, Joel Patnaud, Clara Neipert, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and our engineers today, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.